Good. All right. Our topic for tonight is the third round of the War of Independence, which lasted from about the middle of October of 1948 until early November, followed by a ceasefire, which was a failure of a ceasefire, and that left the war still uncertain. Which means that next week we'll talk about the fourth round of fighting, which was followed by the real ultimate ceasefire. But interesting things happened in the third round of fighting. Okay. So Egypt had no interest in renewing the war in the middle of October. They were overextended and they were short on ammunition. They hadn't destroyed Israel or defeated the IDF, but they had saved a substantial part of Palestine for the Arabs. From the Israeli perspective, things were not good. The bulk of the partitioned Jewish state, the Negev, was not in her hands, and the Jewish settlements were still cut off. If the October 14th borders had become permanent, Israel would be a truncated state and extremely vulnerable. So a status quo of no war and no peace, which had lasted from July 18th until October 14th, was unsustainable. It was especially unsustainable economically. Israel can't afford to have 13% of its citizenry mobilized in uniform, away from the fields, away from the factories, just sitting around with guns, doing nothing, waiting for a war to break out again. Can't do that forever. Now, the IDF knew that the Egyptians were politically isolated and militarily vulnerable, and so they wanted to attack and drive Egyptian forces out of the country. This was seen as a plausible goal, something that could really be done. Now, the first stage was Operation Yoav. Operation Yoav, which would last October 15th to October 22nd, and would sever the link between the eastern and western wings of the Egyptian invasion. It would surround Fallujah, which was on the road connecting the east and west wings, and it would sever the Rafah-Ashdod road along the coast. During this operation of Yoav, the eastern wing would crumble, and the Egyptians would retreat back to Sinai. Ben-Gurion knew that the UN was not going to like this, and that they would insist upon a ceasefire if the Jews were winning. And that ceasefire was going to happen 4 or 5 days into the fighting, at most 7 days. This is a common theme throughout the history of Israel's wars, that they know when they're on the verge of success, of winning, they will be stymied by political and international diplomatic developments. And so they have to calculate this ahead of time. How many hours, how many days do we have to get the job done before the UN puts a stop to the whole thing? Okay. They would have to act fast. It was necessary for the Egyptians to be seen as having fired first. It was important that the Jews not be blamed for instigating this round of fighting. So you need a pretext. Well, the Egyptians typically fired at convoys that were connecting the various settlements along the southern ridge of Israel proper, meaning north of the Egyptian-held territory. On October 15th, the Egyptians didn't fire. Israel was looking, so where's the action? Where's the gunfire? And it didn't happen. The convoy was getting closer and closer to its destination. Finally, the Egyptians fired a few shots, and Israel blew up an oil tanker on purpose to increase the commotion. So it was like a false flag operation a little bit to intentionally blow up your own oil tanker to make a big, big to-do. And a ground battle broke out. The Yitzhak Rabin recalled, with those few shots fired, we had our pretext, and now we could go to all-out war. One of the things that happened in this round of fighting was that the Israel Air Force, the IAF, went on full attack and took every airplane it had into the sky and did battle over the Egyptian airfields at El Arish. It was like a Pearl Harbor, said the Egyptians. They were caught off guard, and many of their aircraft were destroyed. Although ultimately air power was marginal to the outcome of this particular battle. The ground battle lasted from October 15th to October 19th and did not go all that well. David Ben-Gurion was dissatisfied with what happened during this operation and said, quote, our boys are not yet soldiers, which is a nice way of saying that when they were in the Haganah, in the underground, they fought nicely as freedom fighters against the British, but against the real army, they've yet to prove that they can deliver a knockout blow to the opponent. He also feared that Yigal Alon, who was at that time just a 30-year-old young commander of the Southern Front, was not up to the challenge of commanding such a wide front. But in truth, Ben-Gurion had misread the situation, because in fact, the IDF was doing reasonably well and was paving the way for clinching victories to follow in the days ahead, and that the Egyptians were actually contemplating full-scale retreat. The Egyptians' eastern thrust, which had gone from Hebron to Beit Lechem to the southern outskirts of Jerusalem, was in total collapse, and Fallujah, which was on the road connecting the east and west wings, was totally surrounded. So the Egyptian line was no longer Ashdod, Ashkelon, Beit Jibrin, Hebron, and Beit Lechem, but rather it was a much shorter line that connected Gaza and Beersheba. And from an Egyptian point of view, it was no longer an issue of retaining parts of Palestine, but rather the Egyptians were now worried that the Jews could invade Egypt. And in fact, they would in the fourth round of fighting. So things were actually going quite well in Yoav. The Egyptians requested help from the Jordanians and the Iraqis, and they were rejected out of hand. And the Israeli intelligence knew this. They had picked up on signals that the Egyptians were diplomatically isolated and they were going to get no help from their Arab brethren. So when the Jews do well and are winning, it's inevitable that the UN is going to call for a ceasefire. And the pressure for a ceasefire and a return to the October 14th lines began as early as October 16th. All right, the UN got busy very quickly. Israel ignored these demands. A unanimous Security Council vote on October 19th had to be taken a little bit more seriously. Still, Israel dragged its feet for another 2 days to give the army time for mop-up jobs and to advance further and secure more territorial gains. Israel accepted the ceasefire on October 21st, and Ralph Bunche, the UN mediator, ordered the ceasefire to begin at noon on October 22nd. Yitzhak Grumbaum, who was a member of the Israeli cabinet, complained that when the Jews are winning, everybody demands a ceasefire, and Israel necessarily complies. When the Jews are losing, nobody demands a ceasefire. That was Grumbaum's realization. But there was time for one more aggressive action. Even with the UN call for a ceasefire, you have a few hours left, about a day left, to take care of one more piece of business. But the question is, what piece of business would that be? And Israel's borders to this very day, in some ways, were determined by the decision that was taken by Yigal Alon on that date in middle October 1948. So he had a choice, and he was given discretion. You can either go westward and take Majdal, which is Ashkelon, and Gaza, or you can go due south and take Beersheba. So he chose Beersheba. Why? To crush the Egyptian eastern invasion and to solidify Israel's claim on the Negev. Because after all, the partition plan had given the Negev to Israel, but you don't get it unless you take it by force of arms. If it's just on a piece of paper somewhere in New York, that doesn't count for much. So since there was legitimacy to Israel's claim over the Negev, international sanction for it, therefore, make it a reality. As for invading Gaza, it's too dicey. There are too many Arabs there, too many refugees already there. It will complicate the demographic picture too much. And so Yigal Alon made a choice, don't take Gaza, and thus the Gaza Strip became the Gaza Strip and not part of Israel. Ad hayom hazeh. But Be'er Sheva became part of Israel. So Ben-Gurion actually doubted whether Yigal Alon would be able to take the city fast enough before the ceasefire was put into effect. This is part of a general pattern where Alon is a great war hero, but for whatever reason, David Ben-Gurion didn't like him, didn't trust him. In part, it's political. Ben-Gurion is the Mapai, and Alon is the Mapam, and later the Achdut HaAvodah. So there's a factional partisan issue between them, and it played itself out in the course of the war. However, in this instance, Alon proved Ben-Gurion wrong. He was able to take Beersheba essentially without a fight. most of the civilian population had fled to Hebron previously, and those who had not fled previously were expelled to Gaza. 120 Egyptian POWs were taken, and the city was in Israeli hands, never to revert back to anybody else's hands. The Israeli Navy also took one more action on October 21st before the ceasefire went into effect. They took the King Farouk. The King Farouk was the largest boat in the Egyptian Navy. Not surprising, it would be named after the head of state, King Farouk. Okay, he named it after himself. And how was that boat taken? Well, Israel was able to somehow get the naval codes of the Egyptians and figure out where the King Farouk was and send three speedboats in the direction of the King Farouk off the coast of Gaza, each one manned by one sailor. And they went as fast as they possibly could, and in a near suicidal mission, rammed into the hull of the King Farouk. And the three naval officers of Israel on each boat jumped off the side of the boat about 5 seconds before the crash. And all of them survived and were picked up by their fellow sailors about 3 or 4 minutes later. And in appreciation for their bravery, David Ben-Gurion took them out for lunch the next day. Okay, so this was off the coast. There was another attempt just before the ceasefire went into effect to take Beit Jala and Beit Lechem. But this effort failed. And because of that, Beit Jala became part of the West Bank, as opposed to Gilo, which is the Hebrew equivalent of Beit Jala, which became part of municipal Jerusalem eventually. But I remember on my first trip to Israel in 2002, I went at the height of the Intifada, the second Intifada, on a trip with the Great Neck Synagogue. And I remember our tour guide from Emunah of America took us to Gilo to see the space between Gilo and Beit Jala. And Beit Jala is right next to Beit Lechem. And they took us to the other side of the security fence. And I saw the bullet holes. And I said to myself, what am I, crazy? Why am I on the wrong side of the fence? They're gonna shoot us. So I quickly went around to the other side of the fence and told my friends, maybe you should do the same thing. But Beit Jala, there was an attempt to capture it. It failed. Further attempts at making conquest in the southern West Bank were not taken. And the reason is because Ben-Gurion feared antagonizing the Christian world. He really didn't want to take Beit Lechem if he didn't have to. Didn't want to rouse the ire of Christendom, and also didn't want to give a pretext for the United Nations to insist that Israel give up its recently gained territories and give back Beersheba. Okay, so all along the southern front, the Palestinian population retreated together with the Egyptian soldiers. The enfeebled would stay behind, only to be expelled by the IDF. Alon gave no written orders on the southern front about what happened to civilians, but his subordinates understood that the goal was to clear out the territory of civilian population. So this was the last piece of Yoav in the south, and to a certain extent in the center of the country. There's one little wrinkle to the story, and that is the involvement of Machal, of Mitnadvei Chutz La'aretz, those who volunteered from the diaspora. And I'm going to call on Hoffer, my friend Hoffer Kaback, just to say for 1 minute about his cousin, Stanley Andrews, who sadly died in the battle for the first battle for Iraq, Sweden, on October 20th in Operation Yoav. So Hoffer, I'm going to unmute you. Take it away.
Okay, can you hear me?
I can hear you, yeah.
Okay. Quick points with 1 minute deadline. Number one, anyone who has not seen the film Above and Beyond, which was produced by Nancy Spielberg, Steven Spielberg's sister, would profit from doing so. It goes into great detail about the Machal pilots, and there were only 4 planes in the Israeli Air Force at that time. My cousin, Stan Andrews, who's my first cousin once removed, my father, late father's first cousin, is highlighted there in several scenes, but then he was shot down and killed on October 20th, 1948. The reason is that they were supposed to make only one pass over the Egyptian setup there, and they made the first pass, and they decided to make a second bombing run against orders, which was not the wise decision. Lastly, two other points is that the 101st Squadron, which was the name of the Israeli Air Force of four planes, still exists to this date, and they use the logo that was created literally on a napkin by my cousin and his good pal. It's a skull and cross a skull with a, in a aviator cap, and you can actually buy, I have a wall clock that has that. And you can buy that from an outfit called Cafe Press. And the last thing is that there is on the internet a lot of material on the pilots, for, the Machal pilots, including my cousin, but various others from numerous countries. And there's a lot of stuff on the internet if one wants to learn about their contribution. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so... Okay, so the Operation Yoav was a great victory, but it was not comprehensive. In the days after October 22nd, the IDF tried to bolster its victory by taking measures wherever there were no UN observers, especially in the East. So if you could get away with cheating, you get away with cheating a little bit. Psychological warfare, occasional skirmishes, and bad treatment of civilians were all used to soften up the other side. The IDF took Beit Jibrin from the Jordanians on October 24th, and the final clash between those two countries over the course of the war. So I've tipped my hand here. Even though the war will continue for another 2 months, the Jews and the Jordanians do not fight at all after October 24th. On October 29th, the IDF committed certain atrocities at Dawayima. The Mapam ordered that this be investigated. It turned out 100 civilians were killed in a not-so-kosher way. The IDF nibbled away on the Western Front, taking Ashdod on October 28th and Ashkelon on November 4th without a battle. Why was there no battle? Because the Egyptians were afraid, and they already were withdrawing back to Gaza. There was an inconsistent policy about whether or not to expel civilians. At Ashdod, they were expelled. At Ashkelon, they were allowed to stay. However, non-locals were ferreted out and expelled. In early November, the Egyptian army wanted to negotiate a separate peace with Israel. A separate peace always has like a negative connotation, like you're selling out your side. In the World War II, there was always a fear there'd be a separate peace in the East or in the West. You know, so the Egyptians wanted one because they really were desperate. However, to save face, they asked the Jordanians to pretend as though it was their idea. In other words, let King Abdullah be seen as the loser, as the non-patriotic Arab. But nothing ever came of it. Israel didn't want peace just yet. On November 8th and 9th, the IDF finally took Iraq Sweidan in one of the most famous battles of the war. And in fact, there may be someone listening to this class right now whose husband was in that battle. Gideon, if you're listening, wasn't your father-in-law in the battle? So the Fallujah pocket was shrinking, and Colonel Taha met with Yigal Alon to discuss a surrender. And Alon told him the following. He said, listen, buddy, we kicked out the British with our own bare hands, and now we're fighting you. But this is really a silly war. Why are you fighting us? You're the Egyptians. You should go back home and kick out the British from your country, just like we did. And then we can have peace between us. In other words, that the colonial imperialists are the bad guys, and let us each do what we need to do on our own terms, and then we'll have shalom, we'll have peace between us. To which Taha said, I'm sorry, but I got to follow orders, and the orders are no peace right now. So after Iraq Sweidan, the ceasefire was largely restored, for the most part restored. And Israel took internal measures to make sure that Arab refugees did not return. Some villages were burned to the ground. And in November 23rd, 25th, further territory was taken in Operation Lot. Now, let me ask you a question. If this is called Operation Lot, where did it happen? Unmute yourself and give me an answer. Operation Lot. No?
Dead Sea.
What?
Dead Sea.
Good, good, good. Okay, so Operation Lote was the IDF pushed eastward and linked the northern Negev with the southern sections of the Dead Sea, and they took Sodom, and the Sodom Chemical Works plant was taken. Well, Gideon is responding. Anna Fite is on the class tonight. She wants to contribute. Okay, let me unmute her for 1 second to discuss Iraq's way done. Unmute. Okay, Anna, take it away.
So my husband was the chief hero of the Iraqi Sudan, and then he captured Hill 105, and he got the top medal of honor of the War of Israel of 48. One of three people. The two other were posthumous, and my husband was the only living survivor that got the medal of honor for that whole operation.
Wow. Yeah. Thank you very much, Anna. Thank you. Okay, so the battlefield games doomed the plan by Folk Bernadotte to give the Negev to the Arabs and give Galilee to the Jews. The Egyptian diplomats offered Israel an armistice in exchange for Egypt retaining all the territory that would have gone to the Arab state in the south and the west under their partition plan. The Israeli cabinet actually agreed to this. However, they said you could have the northwestern Negev portions, the desert areas, but no Egyptian presence in Gaza. Why no Egyptian presence in Gaza? Because it was believed that if they were there, there would be a launching pad for future aggression. Was that ever with foresight? Because in fact it was. The whole issue of Fedayeen in the early 1950s is because the Egyptians controlled Gaza and facilitated attacks on Israel proper. Okay, so nothing came of all these negotiations. The United Nations Security Council on November 16th called for direct armistice talks between the two sides. This was a great success for Israel. Why was it a great success? Because the earlier UN resolution had been for a return to the October 14th lines, which were not very good lines. The November 16th resolution said, talk amongst yourselves, make peace. It would force the Arab side to sit down at a table face to face with the Jews, something they had been reluctant to do out in the open up until that time. Whatever negotiations had happened had been behind closed doors with nobody knowing about it, because it would be embarrassing for the Arab leaders to be accused of sitting down with Jews. Okay. The United Nations General Assembly on December 11th passed Resolution 194. Resolution 194 will not go down in Zionist history as something that we Jewish people are especially fond of. 194, yes, it called for a peaceful resolution to the conflict with recognition of the existence of all the sovereign states, which meant Israel as well. However, it did not speak of a favorable territorial outcome for Israel, and it did call for the return of refugees to their homes. This would have meant the end of Israel as a Jewish state, because it would have upset the demographic balance, which had been achieved by the exile of a significant Palestinian population over the previous bunch of months. Now, the other thing that this resolution called for was the appointment of a Palestine Reconciliation Commission. And reconciliation commissions are fine from a third party's point of view, but usually the direct parties don't do well when you have people coming intervening and saying, well, we think this is fair or that is fair. Nobody wants fairness. They want to win. That's the real truth. Okay. So Israel wanted the North Central Galilee that was still in the hands of the Arab Liberation Army. The border as it stood was like a plunging neckline, where Israel controlled the southern Galilee, the northeastern Galilee, and the northwestern Galilee, but not the north central Galilee. So imagine like this, a plunging neckline. And they want the entire Galilee up until the Lebanese border. So the army is going to go on an operation, Operation Hiram, or Operation Hiram. Why is it called Operation Hiram? Who knows their Bible? Who is Hiram?
He was the king of Sidon.
So he was a Lebanese king from biblical times, and the operation was to go all the way up to the Lebanese border, and maybe beyond it, we shall see, maybe even beyond the border, in a dangerous gambit. So Ben-Gurion was worried that we need to have a pretext. We can't just go to war, break the ceasefire, if the other side doesn't fire first. So we got to find some way to get them to fire first, and fortunately, it wasn't that hard. A pretext was provided on October 22nd, but still, Ben-Gurion hesitated, not wanting to initiate a large-scale operation that would be seen as disproportionate to the provocation. And yet, things kind of got out of hand, they escalated, and war was inevitable. Moshe Sharet, the foreign minister, was moderately opposed to the taking of the North Central Galilee pocket because of the high number of Arab refugees living there and the likelihood that if the war were to happen and Israel were to take that territory, that in fact more refugees would come into that territory from Lebanon and Syria. Because why? Because the Arabs want to be part of Israel. That's the little secret. The dirty little secret was the Arabs wanted to become citizens of the State of Israel. And they figured if this territory is going to become part of Israel proper, in some conclusion of the warfare, we want to be there. So Sharet, always sensitive to demographic considerations, was reluctant to authorize warfare in that zone. Of course, he was overruled by Ben-Gurion and the rest of the cabinet and defense establishment. They wanted the pocket. How do you solve the problem that Sharet was thinking about? Very simply, you dispossess the population and force even more people into exile. It sounds pretty cruel, and that's to an extent what happened, but not entirely what happened. We shall see. There was not an ethnic cleansing here. There actually were plenty of Arabs who stayed behind and become citizens of Israel, and their descendants are Israelis ad hayom hazeh. Okay, so Ben-Gurion was concerned that Bernadotte's plan of swapping the Negev for the Galilee, which had been stymied by Israel's victories in the south, and so now the UN might want to do a different swap. The Jews get the Negev and the Arabs get the Galilee, meaning one side can't get both. You have to give one side, one piece to one side and one piece to the other side. So Ben-Gurion is afraid some international resolution is going to call for an Arab Galilee, and he doesn't want that. So make it a fait accompli that it's a Jewish Galilee. Well, Operation Hiram would do exactly that. There were no written orders concerning the civilian population, but Ben-Gurion had previously made clear for his desire for the area to be rik, empty of Arabs. It took 3 days, October 28th to the 31st, to conquer the last section of the Galilee, and the ALA, the Arab Liberation Army, did not do very well for itself. They fought embarrassingly poorly. They were, in fact, all sick with typhus or typhoid or various other diseases. The physicians who took care of them later said they were all ill. Israel then conquered 15 villages in southern Lebanon, south of the Litani. Coming from the eastern Galilee panhandle, they went across westward and then swooped downward to conquer a nice swath of Lebanese territory. Some of these villages signed surrender instruments. Some welcomed the conquerors as liberators or just as friendly folks, and some wanted to be annexed to Israel. Annexed to Israel, I tell you. These were Shiite villages, which historically had decent relations with the Yishuvim of the north. Israel controlled the villages with periodic patrols for the next 6 months, until the armistice of March 1949 called for an Israeli withdrawal to the international frontier. Now, the cabinet never authorized the invasion of Lebanon. It kind of just happened. Well, wait a second. Invasions of other countries don't just happen. Why did it happen? And if it wasn't done with political authorization, had the military get away with it? So I'll explain. Firstly, Wadi Duba and the Litani River were regarded by the IDF Northern Command as natural boundaries that were more easily defended than the Israeli-Lebanese border. Remember, what topographical feature is there on the Israeli-Lebanese border? The answer, nothing. It's just a fence now. But there's no, it's kind of arbitrary. Why is the border here as opposed to a kilometer further south or further north? I couldn't tell you. All right. So if you have a body of water, a river, or a wadi, at least, is not a flat surface, so then it makes sense. You can hold it more readily. Another reason to conquer part of Lebanon was it will be possible, potentially, to swap that territory with Israeli territory held by the Syrians. Now, if you recall from the last few sessions, Syria invaded Israel on the day of Israel's birth and was successful in occupying certain areas east of the Kinneret and a little bit even west of the Kinneret and along the southern edge. So there are three sections of territory totaling about 30 square miles that were controlled by the Syrians. The thinking was, if you can't dislodge them in warfare, or you don't want to go to war to dislodge them, then a trade-off. Take a little bit of Lebanon. It's easy. After all, Lebanese are always a pushover. And with that, you'll make a deal. Okay. The IDF committed certain atrocities during Khiram, which can't be overlooked. And presumably they did so to precipitate the flight of civilians. However, as I mentioned, not all Arab civilians fled during Khiram. Probably about 30,000 fled, but just as many stayed, creating the Arab population of the Galilee today. There was a policy to depopulate all Arab villages within 5 kilometers of the Lebanese border. This was enforced to an extent, but not consistently, and some villages were allowed to remain. Refugees were encouraged to leave, and then they were prevented from coming back. Okay. Who's going to live in the Galilee? If a lot of people are leaving, well, who's coming in? The answer is that Ben-Gurion wanted Jews to settle in the Galilee right away. The major Jewish cities were getting crowded, and he saw that an empty Galilee was a solution to a demographic problem. Also, the new settlements would be like a Maginot line of defense against any future Arab invasion. Because the results of Operation Khiram dovetailed nicely with Bernadette's plan, the subsequent UN resolutions called for a withdrawal to the October 15th lines in the south, but not in the north. And somewhat surprisingly, they don't mention a withdrawal from Lebanon. So this is very weird. Normally the UN is an enemy of Israel, we think, and they always want Israel to withdraw back to its borders and not to occupy anybody's territory. But as it turned out, no. Israel occupied part of southern Lebanon and the UN did nothing about it. Very, very shocking. Okay. Now, the ALA was knocked out of the war and basically ceased to exist. Operation Khiram was very lopsided. 400 dead Arabs and 20 dead Israelis. Extremely lopsided battle. The Syrians didn't intervene to save the ALA. Why did they not intervene? The answer, they don't want to go to war with Israel. They have their territory that they're occupying. They stole portions of northeastern Israel. And they know that if they go to fight against the Israelis, what's going to happen? They will lose their gains. So nobody wants to lose their gains. The Lebanese did nothing. Why did the Lebanese do nothing? After all, part of their territory was taken. Well, the answer is, and this is very important, the Lebanese did not want to see the Palestinians in the Galilee successful. They actually wanted the ALA to be crushed. They had no interest in an ALA state or a Mufti-controlled state on their southern border. The Lebanese wanted quiet relations with the Jewish state of Israel and were basically happy that the North Central Galilee went to Israeli hands. And if in the short term a few of their villages on their side of the border had to be occupied, so be it. But the Lebanese army wasn't going to intervene. Okay. There was a downside to the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in that it made Israel, and Ben-Gurion in particular, look like an imperialistic megalomaniac. That he wants to conquer the world. And in fact, in certain moments during the war, Ben-Gurion did have this delusions of grandeur. He said, we're going to bomb Cairo, we're going to bomb Damascus, we're going to bomb Amman, we're going to bomb Beirut. He went a little meshuggah sometimes, Ben-Gurion. It got to his head. But with that downside, there was still a concrete bird in the hand. Israel was able to take something that it could negotiate with later on. What happens to the North Central Galilee, the area that had been heavily Arab and now was taken by Israel? What happens to the people who lived there and who didn't leave and who became Israelis? Is life good for them? Well, actually, no, it's not. Israel put a military administration in the North Central Galilee that lasted until 1966. And for those of you who were with me last year when we discussed the Israeli political history, you'll recall that we spent a significant amount of time discussing the left-wing political parties. So left of the Mapai, meaning the Mapam, the communists, the Arabs, who were agitating for an end to military administration over Arab civilians in the Galilee, on the premise that it was unfair, it was anti-democratic, and so on and so forth. And eventually, it came to an end, but not when Ben-Gurion was prime minister. Who was prime minister? Levi Eshkol. And Eshkol, one of the things that he did was relax the military administration over the ethnic minority in the north. Okay, so things were quiet. Things were pretty quiet in November and in most of December. But the war wasn't over. Remember, there's just the UN-imposed ceasefire that was periodically violated, and then things quieted down. But there's no peace here. There's no peace between Israel and Egypt, between Israel and Jordan, between Israel and Syria or Lebanon. There's no peace at all. And Israel could not afford to end the war at that point, because Operation Yoav had not been decisive. Operation Hiram had been what was it set out to do. It was very successful. But in the south, Operation Yoav was not the be-all and end-all. And the no-war, no-peace situation could not continue indefinitely. Just as I said 35 minutes ago when we began tonight's session, that the third round of fighting had to happen because the second round of fighting left Israel vulnerable. Well, the fourth round of fighting was going to have to happen because the third round left Israel vulnerable. So what was this, the reality on the ground after the third round of fighting and during the third ceasefire? Well, in the north, the Syrians still held parts of Israel, small swaths of territory, but still they held part of Israel. In the central sector, the Jordanians and the Iraqis were just a short tank thrust away from Tel Aviv. Now, granted, the Jordanians had not shown any interest in making that tank thrust, and Abdullah was a reasonable guy who wasn't out to commit genocide, but still, you got to be worried. You know, if the waist of Israel is only 12 miles wide, you get a little nervous. And Jerusalem was surrounded on three sides, on the east, the north, and the south. Only on the western side is there a narrow corridor from Israel proper to Jerusalem. And in the south, Egypt held Gaza, the Fallujah pocket, and was still mildly threatening Beersheba. So the IDF made a determination, a very important determination, that would greatly impact the borders of Israel as we know them. They said Israel could take the West Bank in 5 days, if you give us the green light. If the politicians in the cabinet give us the green light, in 5 days, the West Bank is ours. But the diplomats told them not to do it. Why? Well, concerned about demographics, on the premise that the population of the West Bank was not going to run away, and concern about antagonizing the Jordanians and their British overlords and not wanting to go to war with England. As it turned out, Israel would go to war with England, but not in the central sector, in the southern sector. And, you know, other factors were in play, religious factors, not wanting to rouse the ire of Christendom, whatever it might be. The diplomats said, don't go to war in the central sector. But what about in the south? That's an entirely other matter. And so Israel was annoyed with the November 4th UN resolution. The UN resolution had called for in the south Israel to return to the October 14th borders. But it was absurd. And why was it absurd? Let me explain something very important here. Everybody perk up your ears a little bit. What was so absurd about that UN resolution? Remember, in 1947, November 29th, 1947, the UN decided to partition Palestine. And the Negev, or the bulk of the Negev, was given to the Jewish state. Egypt invaded and occupied sections of the Negev that were supposed to go to the Jewish state. On October 14th, they had part of those territories. On October 15th, Israel attacks and repulses the Egyptians and takes back the territory. So now Israel has territory that it was supposed to have, lost temporarily and got back. And yet the UN Security Council makes a statement saying, no, even though this was territory that we originally gave to you and you have it now, but still because the Egyptians had it a little bit because they stole it, give it back to them. Because their theft was legitimate. So it was an absurd UN resolution, and Israel did not like it. The Americans understood the problem with that resolution, and on November 16th called for direct armistice talks, which was good. But as I said a few moments ago, Farouk would be embarrassed to engage in open armistice talks. He needed a win. needed something to show for his efforts. What was the main consideration that the Egyptians had in terms of how the war should end? The one thing they wanted more than anything else, meaning they're not going to destroy the Jewish state, they're not going to kill all the Jews, none of that's going to happen. What's the one thing they really, really want? They want to connect the Maghreb and the Mashrek. What is the Maghreb? What is the Mashrek? The Maghreb is the Arab, the Muslim world of North Africa, and the Mashrek is the Arab Muslim world of Asia. How do you connect Arab Africa and Arab Asia? By controlling the southern Negev with access between the Sinai Desert and the Jordanian Desert. What would prevent that? If the Jews take the Negev. If the Jews take the Negev all the way down to Eilat and have a border on the Red Sea, on the Gulf of Aqaba, then there is no connectivity. Okay. So a more immediate crisis for Egypt was how to prevent the destruction or the ignoble surrender of the 4,000 soldiers who were trapped in the Fallujah pocket, including Gamal Abdel Nasser, the future president of Egypt. In December, Farouk offered some deal. It was a bluff. It was fake. Ben-Gurion figured that the Arabs only understand force and that they will hate the Jews for having defeated them and that no piece of paper will ever be a real peace treaty until such time as the Arabs are given the bludgeoning of their lives, and then they'll know they can't defeat Israel. So Ben-Gurion was firm that foreign forces had to be expelled from the country. You had to expel foreign forces from the country. What's considered a foreign force? The Egyptians. Why? Because Egypt is not Israel, and Egypt is not Palestine. What's not a foreign force? The Jordanian Legion. Why? Because Jordan really is Palestine, and Palestine is Palestine, and the West Bank is Palestine. So they're not foreign. They're just taking whatever the Arabs get. But Egypt, that's foreign. Get them out of here. Okay. The war had to happen very soon. Why very, very soon? Because immigration and settlement require a quick end to the war. You need money. You need manpower. You need all the effort, the human and material resources of the country to be put into immigration and settlement. And the Jews are pouring into the country even during wartime. So this war, as important as it is, you got to get it over with. Come on. It's got to come to an end. So Ben-Gurion, what does he want? He wanted two things. And in the cabinet meetings of early December, he expressed himself. He said, I want two things. One, I want to expel the Egyptians. And secondly, I want to widen the waste against the Jordanians. What does it mean to widen the waste? Well, the waste of Israel is only about 12 miles wide at the narrow point on the coastal plain. So what do you have to conquer to narrow the waste? Tulkarem and Kalkilia. But don't go to Kalkilia, they'll kill you. All right? So that's what he wanted to take. The furthest western regions of what today we call the West Bank, to make Israel wider, not so narrow. But what did the other members of the cabinet say about all this? Because Israel is a democracy, and Ben-Gurion does not always get what he wants. Remember, in last week's session, we mentioned the Bechiyahu Dorot, that one time he wanted the West Bank, and they said no, and he said, we'll cry for generations over this. So Ben-Gurion does not always get what he wants. The other members of the cabinet have a say. Yitzhak Grunbaum, who was an independent cabinet member, a leader of Polish Jewry, he opposed widening the waste because he said Israel doesn't need more Arab citizens and you're not going to expel the people in the area conquered, so it's just going to upset the demographics. Don't do it. Also, why provoke the British? He favored taking the Negev all the way down to Eilat. Like Ben-Gurion and unlike Moshe Sharet, Grunbaum favored a Jordanian West Bank and opposed Palestinian statehood. So this is very, very interesting. Some cabinet members wanted an independent state of Palestine, and some wanted a Jordanian West Bank. There's a logic in each direction, but there was no unanimity here. There was machlokes. Okay. Bechor Meir Shitrit, who was the Minister for Minority Affairs, he opposed the two-front war. He said, you can't go to war in two different places. David Remes, the Minister of Transportation, also says you can't go to war in two places at once. The IDF is not strong enough to do that. Okay, so Ben-Gurion says, no, don't worry, guys. It won't be simultaneous. It'll be one after the other. We'll first do one, and then we'll do the next. Okay, but Many cabinet members assumed that the IDF was too weak to take and to hold Eilat. Why? Because it's very far away. I mean, it's a long drive down the road to Eilat, and there hardly is even a road. It's like a dirt path. So how many people are you going to send there, and how are they going to hold it? Not so simple. Mordechai Bentov from the Mapam wondered what the plan was for the 100,000 Arab residents south of Beersheba if Israel were to conquer the area. Now, remember, the Mapam is always very concerned about human rights and the Arabs, and they're not interested in dispossessing people. They're always the left-wing moral force in the discussion. And Ben-Gurion is always indifferent to these things. Peretz Bernstein, the head of the General Zionists, which is the centrist-slash-right-wing party, opposed nibbling on the West Bank and opposed a Palestinian state. He said it's got to be Jordanian, not Palestinian. Eliezer Kaplan, who was the finance minister, opposed any further territorial advances. Why? Because he wanted to get the war over with and get on with peacemaking and building the economy. In his view, the finances of the state simply could not bear further warfare. You had to have a peacetime economy. Okay. Now, Bentov, from the Mapam, wanted the status quo and preferred a Palestinian state over Jordanian annexation. So here again, the far left wants a Palestinian state, and the centrists and the rightists want a Jordanian occupation. Why did the left-winger favor a Palestinian state? Because he feared that if Iraq and Jordan were to take the West Bank permanently, they would be a great threat to little Israel, a great Hashemite kingdom of Jordan and Iraq, and a little Israel, and they'd threaten little Israel. Whereas if it was a Palestinian state, it would be a little Palestine and a comparatively bigger Israel, a big Israel, and the little Palestine would be economically and politically dependent upon the big Israel. Is that true in the long run? Actually, the truth is yes. I mean, since the Oslo agreements, that's basically been true. You have a little Palestinian authority and a dominant Israel. Okay. He also suggested, however, that Jews could move into the West. This requires some explanation. That Bentov of the Mapam wanted a Palestinian state and believed that Jews could move into the West Bank. Why? Why would he think that? Well, the answer is that it's 1948. Not, 2008 or 2020. And so there's no 70-year history at that point of Arab areas being Judenrein. What is there? There's a long history of Palestine, British Mandate Palestine, being of a mixed ethnic country, Jews, Arabs, Muslims, Christians, Jews, who all don't like each other but live in one territorial entity. And the state of Israel has Muslim and Arab Christian citizens, so why shouldn't a Palestinian state have some Jewish citizens? Why does it have to be entirely devoid of Jews? So here you have the Mapam, which is a conglomerate of the Shomer HaTzair and the Achdut HaAvodah, basically saying, we believe in greater Israel, but we can have greater Israel from a settlement point of view without greater Israel from a diplomatic and political point of view. That there could be Jews in Beit El and in Shiloh and in the Jordan Valley, except they're not in Israel. They're not Israelis. They're Palestinians, and they live with the Arabs. So this, to my mind, is an absurdity. To your minds today in 2020 is an absurdity. To David Ben-Gurion in 1948, it was an absurdity. To Mordechai Bentov and the Mapam, they thought it was plausible. But you know what? They were ridiculous. It was never plausible. Okay. There was a need to act fast and to engage in the fourth round of fighting before the Palestinian Conciliation Commission got into the country. It was decided, but without a formal vote, to reignite the war against Egypt. Israeli intelligence knew that both the Americans and the Soviets would not stand in the way of an Israeli attack on Egypt. Now, why not? For a few reasons. One, in the case of the Soviets, they wanted Jewish control of the Negev to break the contiguity, the territorial contiguity of British control over Egypt and Jordan. Remember, although Egypt and Jordan are sovereign states, they have British military bases all over the place and really are surrogates for the British. So the Russians, the Soviets, who are in a Cold War with the British, They want an Israeli Negev down to Eilat to form a buffer between the two parts of the Arab world. The Americans, the Truman administration, also very much favors a Jewish Negev. Why? Well, Chaim Weizmann had spent the past few months badgering Harry Truman to convince him of the importance of a Jewish Negev, and that the Negev would be useful in settling the hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Jewish refugees from the Holocaust. In other words, the Americans don't want all the Jews to come to America. The Americans want the Jews to go somewhere else. You know, nobody likes the Jews especially. So have the Jews go to Israel. But Israel, if it's a truncated state, can't accommodate all these people. What do you need? Open space. Where is there open space? The Negev. Okay, so the Americans and the Soviets are in favor of this. What happened? The night after the cabinet decision to allow for war, Ben-Gurion went to the opera, the Tel Aviv opera, and he sat next to the American ambassador, and on the other side of him was the Soviet ambassador. So he knew that he was in good with both sides of the Cold War at that point. However, Ben-Gurion made a little bit of a blunder. You know, nobody's perfect. Nobody's perfect. And even Ben-Gurion made mistakes in the conduct of the war. So his biggest mistake, of course, was the battles of Latrun, where he kept throwing kids into the fire and it didn't work out well. But his biggest diplomatic blunder was right here, and with regard to the Soviet Union. Now, if you recall, over the past bunch of weeks, I said that the Soviet Union was supportive of Zionism ever since Andrei Gromyko's speech in May of 1947 at the UN General Assembly calling for partition, followed by Czechoslovakia, which was a Soviet satellite, basically, a communist country in the Eastern Bloc, selling arms to Israel, followed by Soviet recognition of Soviet voting for partition, Soviet recognition of Israel on May 15th, 1948, not de facto, but de jure, which was even better than the Truman administration. So the Russians were good. You know, they welcomed Golda Meir as ambassador to Moscow, and they even opened up the Choral Synagogue in Moscow for 1,000 people on Yom Kippur in 1948. So very bizarre that while Stalin was still alive, there was this year and a half flirtation with Zionism and Israel. But it came to an abrupt, well, not an abrupt end, but a fairly quick end. Ben-Gurion made a mistake. He pressed the Soviets for relaxing the restrictions on Jewish emigration from the Soviet Union to Israel on the premise that if Israel was going to re-engage in war with Egypt and the other Arab states, that they needed manpower and that military-aged men, you know, boys, young men in Moscow and Leningrad and Stalingrad, whatever, throughout the Ukraine, who are eager to make aliyah to Israel, should be allowed to go because it's in a Soviet interest for the Israeli for the IDF to bolster its manpower. So he pressed for this, and Stalin's regime and the foreign ministry got very annoyed. Why? It's one thing for them to support Israel in the Middle East. It's quite another for the Israeli Jews to start Mishing Arayim, you know, getting involved in Soviet immigration policy. The Soviets don't want to have ethnic minorities leaving the country in large numbers or being pressured to allow ethnic minorities to leave the country in large numbers, because if you allow it for the Jews, you have to allow it for every other minority. And then the whole Soviet system collapses because nobody really wants to be in a communist society. So this was the beginnings of the end of the flirtation between the Russians and Zionism, which would eventually lead to the breaking off of relations altogether. Okay, there's a question in the chat from Joanne. Will you do a class on the current situation of extending law to the settlements? I'd prefer not to, because it's too controversial, and my opinion is not necessarily one that would go over well. Okay, any other questions before we conclude for tonight? Any other questions? Unmute yourself. Unmute.
Immigration is not only the people, but it's also the problem of secession. There is the implication. For example, in Chechnya, that there is a Muslim minority that wishes to have its autonomy, but it's also the next step to become independent.
Right, become independent. Correct. Okay, so for next week, We're gonna finally conclude the war. We're gonna go through the fourth round of fighting, which is Operation Chorev, which one of its highlights is when Israel goes to effectively to war with the British Air Force and shoots down British pilots over the Israel-Egyptian border. And I assume next week also we'll cover the armistice agreements, which are very interesting in their own right, because remember, the Arab world has not reconciled itself to the existence of a Jewish state, but you have to make some sort of an agreement on paper to end this round of hostilities. So how does an armistice differ from a ceasefire? It's more than a ceasefire, but it's less than a peace treaty. It's
that was the meeting in Rhodes, correct?
So that was correct. That was the meeting in Rhodes,
yeah,
overseen by Ralph Bunche, for which he would win the Nobel Prize.
Right, right.
So see you all next time. Have a good week. Take care.
And we'll good week.
About 10 minutes.
Laila Tov.
Laila Tov.